Accession number 9420, Reel 21.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 21. I believe there was an incident when you were called out to an unexploded bomb.
Well, I wasn't called out to it, but it was more or less my personal request, because we'd had a lot of these bombs, delayed action, what they used to call delayed action bombs at Bury, that Jerry began using at the latter end of the war. They were big bombs, and usually 2,000-pounders, and they were about 4 feet high. And there were, I should think, there were about 12 or 18 inches wide. They were huge things, and we'd had reports of them coming in, and of course, as there were the delayed action, the military were always dealt with those. Our people never dealt with them. But of course, Captain Foreman, who was our engineer at the time, he joined the Home Guard at the same time as I did, and he became a captain. He was made a captain before I was, before I sat for my OTC. And he had to be at every emergency committee meeting and report everything that had gone on, because he was really in charge of the incidents themselves that went round in collusion with the incident officer and the chief IRPO and all the officials who were involved in this. And he gave reports about these bombs dropping, and we used to have little chats after the meeting together. And I said to him, he was awarded the George Cross. And so you can tell what sort of a fella he was. He had no nerves. He was a great bloke. We got on cracking together. And he was a Pole, by the way. He couldn't speak fluent English, but he could speak English, and we could understand what he said, but we could hear the accent. And I phoned him up one day, and I said, I forget what his Christian name was now, and I said, anyway, Mr. Foreman, to you, next time you get a big and unexploded bomb, I said, will you tip me off? I'd like to see one. So he said, oh, by all means, sir. So I think he was secretly amused, you know, me asking a thing like that. So we had one drop over at Plaistow by the side of the railway behind a small estate. It was a lovely little estate we had there. And we'd evacuated all the people there as soon as this bomb had dropped. And the military engineers, the bomb disposal people, had been called down because they knew where it had dropped. And it was right alongside, it was below water level, really, that area. And they dug right down, and they'd got, the water would be, it was coming through the sides of the walls, that they'd planked it up, and they'd got two ladders, one way onto a platform, and then another ladder going down. They'd had to dig down to this thing, and...
About how deep would it be?
Oh, I should think it was about 20 feet deep. It must have been 20 or 30 feet deep, because there was two long ladders on either side, and this thing was moving. It was dropping. It's because of the all the mud. It was all the water was still trickling through, and when we got down there, I had a torch together with a bit of daylight, because it was a fairly big hole they'd made. The engineers had done a good job there. They were all around the military there, and they could. This thing was sticking out sideways, just like that. And our foreman says, he said, there you are, sir. So I listened. He said, you can hear it ticking. So I listened to it, and I could hear the bloody thing ticking. You know, it's like a clock. And I was a bit sceptical about all this. You could hear the ticking, you know. But it was quite right. I think it was mad silly curiosity more than anything. I wanted to make sure they were not pulling a fast one, because there was all sorts of yarns going about, you know, at that time about the war, what was going on, and somebody had done something or said something. And I was satisfied. I came up. I said, well, when is this supposed to go off? He said, tomorrow morning, sir. He said, between about 8 and 11. And he went off quarter to 10, I think. Quarter to 10 or 11. I'm not quite sure. Anyway, they were dead right on their timing.
They didn't try and defuse them at all, then?
No. They never tried to defuse a delayed action bomb. Not unless they were absolutely certain they'd got ample time. And it was madness, I think, because they were bloody great things. I mean, they'd make a hole about 20 feet wide, you know, and that is something. And 20 feet deep, too.
That's just landing.
Oh, yes. And no, when they exploded, when the things exploded, 20 feet's a long way, you know. It's this from this wall right out to our back wall, 20 or 30 feet, you know. And I was satisfied. I was, you know, I wanted to know and satisfy myself, and I did.
Talking about bombs, you mentioned earlier you could tell the different types of bombs. Could you tell us how you could tell what sort of bombs?
You talk about the sound of them.
Can you go through them? Can you still remember any of them?
Well, you could hardly hear a 250-pound bomb. The first ones that came down, there'd be a swish and a bang, and it was more like a whiz-bang in the First World War, you know. But the heavier bombs, you could hear them whining, coming through the air before they landed. And then, of course, as you know, they were followed up by the flying bombs. And then after that, they were the doodlebugs, the flying bombs. And you could see those coming around, floating across the sky, and you could almost dodge them, because all you were doing was waiting for the light to go out. And when the light went out, they'd drop straight away. And that's when you had to watch which way they were going, because you more or less see they began to come down when the flames gradually got less before they went out. And then you could tell. I know I had a platoon. I was a platoon officer in the Home Guard at Forest Gate, where we had headquarters at Burton's on the corner of Woodgrange Road. And I know that we had a warning come through there that the doodle bombs were coming over, and we could hear this one in the distance. Then we spotted it, and I had to tell my platoon members to lay down on the floor close, right up against the walls. There was nothing you could do about it. You didn't know where it was coming towards us, and we never knew where it was going to stop or drop, you know. Anyway, it dropped across the road, as a matter of fact, just up the road, as a matter of fact, and it blew bloody hell out of that corner building there. And we had quite a lot of incidents there, and landmines. We had one or two that got caught hanging up in trees that, you know, hadn't exploded. And they were murderous things, they were, because you couldn't hear them coming down. They come down on parachutes. And then the worst ones of all were the rockets, because...
The V2s,
yes, because actually they weren't the worst, because... Death was sudden then, and it didn't matter. You were here one minute and gone the next, and you normally had no time to worry about it. You couldn't worry like you. The doodlebugs used to cause you more worry than what actually, insofar as nerves were concerned, because you never knew where they were going to drop, you know. And you could see the bloody things coming to you, you see, which was a different thing to a rocket. A rocket had come down, and then you'd be gone. And so that was all there was in that, except for people that were damaged by the buildings and subsequent injuries.
Did any of these weapons that you've gone through, did any of them cause more panic? Did anything panic the population at large?
No, strangely enough, it done. It's a good question, that, because you'd have thought with all these things happening and death and destruction and the various forms of bombs and flying missiles that came through... It was just a subject of conversation, like it is now. Somebody gets mugged or murdered or something like that, you know. It was a temporary sensation, but there was no panic. That was your point. And there wasn't any panic because I think people realised that this was war. They began, by the time the doodlebugs, this was in the latter part of the war, you know, and we'd had a belting all those all through those years, raids at all times and in and out, and at the beginning it was on and then it was off and then it was on again. And, you know, it was really harrowing and nerve-breaking and shattering, but after a time, people, like you do in all in life, in all its circumstances, you become accustomed to it. And you shouldn't say that you can get accustomed to war, but this is what happens. People become acclimatised, and whatever happens then, they sort of take it in their stride and expect it, that that is war, and they recognise it as such. And they put up with inconveniences and nuisances and injury and death and all that, and it's amazing how they take it in their stride, even those who've lost people. It was sad, but there was people out in the front, though, getting killed as well, so it all added up together. You couldn't make an exception for anybody or anything.
Now, you were talking about your Home Guard. You joined the Home Guard. When did you join the Home Guard?
Soon as the war broke out. I mean, there was a Home Guard because the way Hitler was making his advances across Europe, we knew we got to watch out for England then, and there was a appeal went out for Home Guard, and those who were sort of above military age, we immediately joined up. And I joined as well, although I had these other commitments on with the council work and my own job. I still had to earn a living. And so I joined the town hall unit.
Do you know its name and what the whole unit name was?
Well, it was an Essex. It was under the Essex, local Essex regiment there, and then we came under the Green, more or less, because local efforts were made, you know, from the, like the factories, where they were forming their Home Guard units too, if they were big enough. And West End being a big place, there's a big factories there. And they set up a town hall unit. Well, I joined the town hall unit as I was on the council. And I remember when we had our first parade there, one of our painters was a sergeant major. He'd been in the First World War. And that's why he was made sergeant major, you see. And one of the local chiefs was an officer, Colonel Dale. And I was given a rifle, and I'd only been taught to form fours, but by that time they'd altered the regimental formation to threes, forming threes. And when I attempted to step back and then to the right again to form four, one behind the other, of course I made a hell of a muddle of it. And same as the slope in arms, they'd altered that, the rifle drill as well. And I made a balls of that as well, you see, because they'd had a little bit of training before I really got my uniform and formed and attended the first parade, my parade anyway. And I noticed that the sergeant major, he never said anything to me. And when we had the tea break, or a 10-minute break, it wasn't a tea break, it was a 10-minute break, he came up to me. Oh, I went up to him and I said, Sergeant Major, I said, I'm not Councillor Gilman here. I said, I'm Private Gilman. I said, you treat me the same as the others. I said, I only know my draw from in the First World War. He said, yeah, I recognise that, sir. I said, and there's no sir in this either, not while I'm on parade here. So he said, all right. Because a lot of them knew me in there, because I knew the Christian names, a lot of the porters even. And those.
The many other councillors in it?
No, it wasn't another councillor joined the Home Guard. Not our eternal unit. There was another councillor one councillor who joined at the Green and the Cedars. That's where I went. I was transferred to when I went for my OTC. I left the town hall.
Before we come to that, how often would the town hall unit meet, and what sort of training did you get with it?
Well, they had the usual Home Guard training, because it all came under the Cedars, actually, you know, which was the centre of the Home Guard regiment for the Essex Regiment, which was at the Cedars in Portway. And, of course, that was an ordinary territorial army headquarters and building before the war. And it was all ready made for us. And there we had the units and regiments and various parts of the baron. They controlled all the companies of the regiment and platoons. And everything was all... And that was where I was recommended to go for the OTC.
But before that, what sort of training was the home? What was normal? You say normal home guard training.
Oh, we used to be taken out to the rifle ranges and for bomb throwing and grenade throwing, you know, and all this kind of thing. And for attack formation, with a diamond formation, you know, that we used to operate in that sense. And also the methods of gas attack and gas mask drill, and everything that was connected that the normal regular army went through, because we were told to be prepared to defend and finish, defend or stay, you know, whether we were overwhelmed or whether we weren't, and that's what we were prepared to do. I mean, it's what you join up for.
What did you think of the training? You'd been through training before. Was it as effective as your First World War training?
Oh, yes, it was good. It was good. Mind you, it was improved because of the weapons. The rifles were much improved pattern. In the First World War, we only had the old Lee Enfields. And, of course, I finished up with it as a Lewis gunner in the First World War. But in this one, there was no question of a Lewis gun then. It was just merely the rifle drill. And then afterwards, I was sat for my OTC, and then I was given a platoon.
How often did you train while you were at the town hall?
Every week.
What, one night a week?
Two nights a week. And then there was report writing and all that, everything. It's a blue bottle, isn't it?
He's gone.
Oh, it's, yes, I was going to say the window is open. Yeah, so it was quite good. I don't know what happened to the town hall unit at the finish, because I left that and went to the Cedars, you see.
How long was it before you were recommended to go to the OTC?
Very shortly afterwards. It was a bit embarrassing, me being on the council. I'd also sat for my silver badge for the ARP, because... Having to go around and...
I'll come to that later. If we could stick with the Home Guard. What did training did you get for the OTC?
I went for 6 or 8 weeks training for the OTC. And then I went to one of the parts of the course was the Police College at Hendon. I spent a week there on unarmed combat. And... I went to quite a number of rifle ranges, you know, for dealing with the targets at the other end of the range, because an officer had to be in charge of that, and I was put through all those all part of the training, and then the reporting and the military tactics and the plan of attack and objectives. Camouflage. I got my camouflage badge. Well, it wasn't a badge. It was a... I don't know what you'd call it, really. It was a certificate, really. Yes, it was a certificate to say... If you went in for any particular course and you passed it, you got a certificate to say, and I got one of those for the... where you could disguise yourself as a bush and you'd be within 10 yards of somebody and they wouldn't see you. And it's a fact. You can do that. You'd be surprised. Well, unless you've had some of it yourself and you know what can be done. But it is amazing how much camouflage or useful it is. Then you've got trajectories and all the effect of measurement of distances and so forth. It's very, very complicated, the military training, you know, and very thorough. And I liked it because of its discipline. And this is why I think that... 2 years national service now would do a lot of good to some of our, of course, to most of our youngsters, because you learn to respect discipline and authority, and to how to control yourself and look after yourself in emergencies. And you, now, of course, they learn trades in the service. So, I mean, it's a gift. It's especially it's helped to reduce the unemployed now at the present time, if I had that.
So... You went, when you finished this 6-week course, you went to the Cedars, the Green. Is that right?
Oh, yes, went back to the Cedars, and there I had a platoon, and we used to go out on marches, and we had mock battles on the flats. And I remember we used to have attacks and take one another, storm each other, you know. And I know we've had quite excitable skirmishes, and we'd have the East Ham crowd attacking the West Ham crowd, you know, and it was all laid on. And then after that, I was made with Captain Formant, because I was going up. I got my first pip and then my second. And then when I got the three pips, you've seen the Gazette, haven't you, London Gazette? That's when I teamed up with Formant more, because he was on the same level as I
you
was.
You given a company then?
Oh, yes, yes. No, a platoon. I had a platoon.
It stayed as a platoon, did it?
In the stages, yes, in the various. Well, I mean, you turned out on civic occasions too, sometimes with your home guard. If there was an event that took place, you know, some might be recruiting or it might be a civic event, you know, you were asked if you could bring some of the home guard along, you know, a platoon, and. Then I, after that...
How did your responsibilities change then in the Home Guard as you got more pips and became a captain?
Well, then you were given more responsibilities, same as I said. I was then appointed as an umpire. I had to go out on umpiring these skirmishes that took place before I was in charge of them and in charge of a platoon defending the area, whatever it is, or attacking the area, whichever it might be. And then as your responsibilities grew, that's when I was made an umpire, just before I was made a captain, and I was made a captain soon after that, because I used to give some interesting reports, you know, on what took place. And we went over quite a large area of Wanstead and Woodford, where there was a lot of open ground over there. And then, of course... As soon as the war finished, the Home Guard was, to my disgust, it wasn't to my disgust. I'm jumping the gun a bit, because when I was disgusted was when, because I transferred from the Home Guard to the cadets, the Army cadets. You see, because I could see the value of this, and we still had to keep the old military forces in operation. And we had Army cadets, and I transferred to the Army cadets as a captain. And I retained my rank there. And later on, I shall remember, we went to a big meeting a few years after the cadets carried on. Amory. Julian Amory, I think, who's now one of the government ministers or front benchers. I remember he got up and he was the one who announced to us that all those who had reached the age of 55 would have to stand down, you know. And I was disgusted with it, because I said that it wasn't, in my opinion, it wasn't necessary. I said that the meeting upset him, but he didn't take any notice of it. He was as hard-boiled as they make them. And anyway, I had to resign because of that from the Home Guard, from the Gazette.
And during the war, you carried on meeting twice a week, did you, the Home Guard, when you were...
Yes, well, there were various... They varied a lot according to circumstances, you know. I mean, if we had... skirmishes on, and I used to go to the camps as well, you know. Later on, when the war finished, I went and I transferred to the cadets. I used to go to the cadet camps as well, and down at out on the east coast somewhere.
Now you mentioned you had a connection with the ARP as well. Can you tell me about that during the war?
Well, the ARP was the Air Raid Precaution Service, and as such, I mean, I only joined that because I was active on the committee, the council committee, and I held a responsible position there. And the thing I concentrated on most was going out and making sudden visits during the night. surprise visits without to see if they were doing their job properly, and the wardens were at their post, and that the post wasn't shut. We found a couple of instances, but that soon stopped.
Did you take you took the ARP training, did you? Did you do the actual...
Oh, yes, I sat for my silver badge because I felt that I couldn't go around and tell wardens and pull them up about not doing their job properly if I hadn't got the badge which they had, because they weren't made wardens unless they'd got their silver badge. They all had to sit for that.
What was this training for the silver badge?
Well, it was training on how to deal with incidents, gas masks and... communications and assisting the various services on incidents, reporting them, making reports out properly, and it was quite something in it, you know. And also being able to draw up street rotas for the wardens that they were in control of, because the chief warden, the post warden, which was the top rank in each warden's post, had a given area of so many streets, and of course he had to decide and allocate these various rotas and duties to the wardens that he'd got under his control. And I used to go around and, as I say, various times, and see that they were doing the job, and I reported back to the emergency committee on what I'd seen and found and everything. And the ARP officer was sitting there, and he used to hear me. And he used to take notes, you know, and if there was anything the committee wanted to alter or decide or improve on, they used to give him the necessary instructions.
Now, you had to carry on your own business work as well.
Oh, well, that was easy for me because I was a collector, and I could make my work was my own business. You see, I was a collector and I only earned a commission of a shilling in the pound at the time. And no holidays, no sick pay or anything like that. Tell you what it was like then in the 30s, you see. And I could arrange my time to fit the duties and things I had joined. And I only joined those things that I could arrange my time to fit into.
Did you have any problem keeping up your commissions? I mean, did...
No. Well, once you got a member... on your mutuality book. I had a mutuality book. It was a shilling in the pound they paid. And, at least a shilling in the pound I got, rather. And they paid their 21 weeks they paid, because the odd shilling we used to be charged as a commission to the co-op. That was the charge they made for the service of me going round. And they used to pay me a shilling in the pound on every pound I collected. And that was and I had to build my book up. And if you made more members, which I did, I'd treble my book.
Even during the war, you got new members?
Oh, yes. Because, I mean, things, you know, they were still difficult to buy, and there was rationing going on as well. And you could only yet to decide what you were going to buy. And you were limited. But there you are. I mean, there was a lot of black market going on as well, as you can imagine. Always is when there's disruption of orderly business.
Were you very aware of the black market? Was it part? Did you take any role in it, stopping it, or?
No, you couldn't. You couldn't control it. You couldn't control it. Where there was a blatant discovery officially, then it was made a case of. But there was very, very little of it, because people couldn't be bothered about things like that during the war. The war was the main business and effort, and this is what happens. It's subordinated by the war. The war is the supreme decider of what happens.